agreed that Mr. Thornton of Milton was not such an unknown name to him as she had imagined it would be. Her dinner was going off well. Henry was in good humour and brought out his dry caustic wit admirably. Mr. Thornton and Mr. Colthurst found one or two mutual subjects of interest, which they could only touch upon then, reserving them for more private after-dinner talk. Margaret looked beautiful in the pomegranate flowers, and if she did lean back in her chair and speak but little, Edith was not annoyed, for the conversation flowed on smoothly without her. Margaret was watching Mr. Thornton's face. He never looked at her, so she might study him unobserved and note the changes which even this short time had wrought in him. Only at some unexpected mot of Mr. Lennox's, his face flashed out into the old look of intense enjoyment. The merry brightness returned to his eyes, the lips just parted to suggest the brilliant smile of former days. And, for an instant, his glance instinctively sought hers, as if he wanted her sympathy. But when their eyes met, his whole countenance changed. He was grave and anxious once more, and he resolutely avoided even looking near her again during dinner. There were only two ladies besides their own party, and as these were occupied in conversation by her aunt and Edith, when they went up into the drawing-room, Margaret languidly employed herself about some work. Presently the gentlemen came up, Mr. Colthurst and Mr. Thornton in close conversation. Mr. Lennox drew near to Margaret and said in a low voice, "I really think Edith owes me thanks for my contribution to her party. You've no idea what an agreeable, sensible fellow this tenant of yours is. He has been the very man to give Colthurst all the facts he wanted coaching in. I can't conceive how he contrived to mismanage his affairs."
"With his powers and opportunities, you would have succeeded," said Margaret. He did not quite relish the tone in which she spoke, although the words but expressed a thought which had passed through his own mind. As he was silent, they caught a swell in the sound of conversation going on near the fireplace between Mr. Colthurst and Mr. Thornton.
"I assure you, I heard it spoken of with great interest, curiosity as to its result, perhaps I should rather say. I heard your name frequently mentioned during my short stay in the neighbourhood." Then they lost some words, and when next they could hear, Mr. Thornton was speaking.
"I have not the elements for popularity. If they spoke of me in that way, they were mistaken. I fall slowly into new projects, and I find it difficult to let myself be known, even by those whom I desire to know, and with whom I would fain have no reserve. Yet even with all these drawbacks, I felt that I was on the right path, and that starting from a kind of friendship with one, I was becoming acquainted with many. The advantages were mutual. We were both unconsciously and consciously teaching each other."
"You say were. I trust you are intending to pursue the same course."
"I must stop, Colthurst," said Henry Lennox hastily, and by an abrupt yet apropos question, he turned the current of the conversation so as not to give Mr. Thornton the mortification of acknowledging his want of success and consequent change of position. But as soon as the newly started subject had come to a close, Mr. Thornton resumed the conversation just where it had been interrupted and gave Mr. Colthurst the reply to his inquiry.
"I have been unsuccessful in business and have had to give up my position as a master. I am on the lookout for a situation in Milton, where I may meet with employment under someone who will be willing to let me go along my own way in such matters as these. I can depend upon myself for having no go-ahead theories that I would rashly bring into practice. My only wish is to have the opportunity of cultivating some intercourse with the hands beyond the mere cash nexus. But it might be the point Archimedes sought from which to move the earth, to judge from the importance attached to it by some of our manufacturers, who shake their heads and look grave as soon as I name the one or two experiments that I should like to try."
"You call them experiments, I notice," said Mr. Colthurst, with a delicate increase of respect in his manner.
"Because I believe them to be such, I am not sure of the consequences that may result from them, but I'm sure they ought to be tried. I have arrived at the conviction that no mere institutions, however wise and however much thought may have been required to organize and arrange them, can attach class to class
as they should be attached, unless the working out of such institutions bring the individuals of the different classes into actual personal contact. Such intercourse is the very breath of life. A working man can hardly be made to feel and know how much his employer may have laboured in his study at plans for the benefit of his workpeople. A complete plan emerges like a piece of machinery, apparently fitted for every emergency. But the hands accept it as they do machinery without understanding the intense mental labour and forethought required to bring it to such perfection. But I would take an idea, the working out of which would necessitate personal intercourse. It might not go well at first, but at every hitch interest would be felt by an increasing number of men, and at last its success in working come to be desired by all, as all had borne a part in the formation of the plan. And even then, I'm sure that it would lose its vitality, cease to be living, as soon as it was no longer carried on by that sort of common interest which invariably makes people find mean ways of seeing each other and becoming acquainted with each other's characters and persons, and even tricks of temper and modes of speech. We should understand each other better, and I'll venture to say we should like each other more.
And you think they may prevent the recurrence of strikes?
Not at all. My utmost expectation only goes so far as this, that they may render strikes not the bitter, venomous sources of hatred they have hitherto been. A more hopeful man might imagine that a closer and more genial intercourse between classes might do away with strikes, but I am not a hopeful man.
Suddenly, as if a new idea had struck him, he crossed over to where Margaret was sitting, and began without preface, as if he knew she had been listening to all that had passed.
"Miss Hale, I had a round robin from some of my men, I suspect in Higgins's handwriting, stating their wish to work for me, if ever I was in a position to employ men again on my own behalf. That was good, wasn't it?"
"Yes, just right. I am glad of it," said Margaret, looking up straight into his face with her speaking eyes, and then dropping them under his eloquent glance. He gazed back at her for a minute, as if he did not know exactly what he was about, then sighed, and saying,
"I knew you would like it,"
he turned away and never spoke to her again until he bid her a formal good night. As Mr. Lennox took his departure, Margaret said, with a blush that she could not repress, and with some hesitation, "Can I speak to you tomorrow? I want your help about something."
"Certainly. I will come at whatever time you name. You cannot give me a greater pleasure than by making me of any use. At 11? Very well."
His eye brightened with exultation. How she was learning to depend upon him. It seemed as if any day now might give him the certainty, without having which he had determined never to offer to her again. Chapter 52. Pack Clouds Away. For joy or grief, for hope or fear, for all hereafter as for here, in peace or strife, in storm or shine. Anon. Edith went out on tiptoe and checked Sholto in all loud speaking that next morning, as if any sudden noise would interrupt the conference that was taking place in the drawing room. 2 o'clock came, and they still sate there with closed doors. Then there was a man's footstep running downstairs, and Edith peeped out of the drawing room. "Well, Henry," said she, with a look of interrogation.
"Well," said he rather shortly.
"Come in to lunch."
"No, thank you, I can't. I've lost too much time here already."
"Then it's not all settled?" said Edith despondingly.
"No, not at all. It never will be settled. If the it is what I conjecture you mean, that will never be, Edith, so give up thinking about it."
"But it would be so nice for us all," pleaded Edith. "I should always feel comfortable about the children if I had Margaret settled down near me. As it is, I am always afraid of her going off to Cadiz."
"I will try, when I marry, to look out for a young lady who has a knowledge of the management of children. That is all I can do. Miss Hale would not have me, and I shall not ask her."
"Then what have you been talking about?"
"A thousand things you would not understand. investments and leases, and value of land.
Oh, go away if that's all. You and she will be unbearably stupid if you've been talking all this time about such wary things.
Very well. I'm coming again tomorrow, and bringing Mr. Thornton with me to have some more talk with Miss Hale.
Mr. Thornton? What is he to do with it?
He is Miss Hale's tenant, said Mr. Lennox, turning away, and he wishes to give up his lease.
Oh, very well. I can't understand details, so don't give them me.
The only detail I want you to understand is to let us have the back drawing room undisturbed, as it was today. In general, the children and servants are so in and out, but I can never get any business satisfactorily explained, and the arrangements we have to make tomorrow are of importance.
No one ever knew why Mr. Lennox did not keep to his appointment on the following day. Mr. Thornton came true to his time, and after keeping him waiting for nearly an hour, Margaret came in looking very white and anxious. She began hurriedly, "I am so sorry Mr. Lennox is not here. He could have done it so much better than I can. He is my adviser in this."
"I am sorry that I came, if it troubles you. Shall I go to Mr. Lennox's chambers and try and find him?"
"No, thank you. I wanted to tell you how grieved I was to find that I am to lose you as a tenant. But Mr. Lennox says things are sure to brighten."
"Mr. Lennox knows little about it," said Mr. Thornton quietly. "Happy and fortunate in all a man cares for, he does not understand what it is to find oneself no longer young, yet thrown back to the starting point, which requires the hopeful energy of youth, to feel one half of life gone, and nothing done, nothing remaining of wasted opportunity, but the bitter recollection that it has been. Miss Hale, I would rather not hear Mr. Lennox's opinion of my affairs. Those who are happy and successful themselves are too apt to make light of the misfortunes of others."
"You are unjust," said Margaret gently. "Mr. Lennox has only spoken of the great probability which he believes there to be of your redeeming, your more than redeeming what you have lost. Don't speak till I have ended. Pray don't." And collecting herself once more, she went on rapidly turning over some law papers and statements of accounts in a trembling, hurried manner. "Oh, here it is. And he drew me out a proposal. I wish he was here to explain it, showing that if you would take some money of mine, £18,057, lying just at this moment unused in the bank, and bringing me in only 2.5%, you could pay me much better interest, and might go on working Marlborough Mills." Her voice had cleared itself and become more steady. Mr. Thornton did not speak, and she went on looking for some paper on which were written down the proposals for security, for she was most anxious to have it all looked upon in the light of a mere business arrangement, in which the principal advantage would be on her side. While she sought for this paper, her very heart pulse was arrested by the tone in which Mr. Thornton spoke. His voice was hoarse and trembling with tender passion as he said,
"Margaret."
For an instant she looked up, and then sought to veil her luminous eyes by dropping her forehead on her hands. Again, stepping nearer, he besought her with another tremulous, eager call upon her name.
"Margaret."
Still lower went the head. More closely hidden was the face, almost resting on the table before her. He came close to her. He knelt by her side to bring his face to a level with her ear, and whispered, panted out the words,
"Take care. If you do not speak, I shall claim you as my own in some strange, presumptuous way. Send me away at once if I must go. Margaret."
At that third call, she turned her face, still covered with her small white hands, towards him, and laid it on his shoulder, hiding it even there. And it was too delicious to feel her soft cheek against his, for him to wish to see either deep blushes or loving eyes. He clasped her close, but they both kept silence. At length she murmured in a broken voice,
"Oh, Mr. Thornton, I am not good enough."
"Not good enough? Don't mock my own deep feeling of unworthiness."
After a minute or two, he gently disengaged her hands from her face and laid her arms as they had once before been placed to protect him from the rioters.
"Do you remember, love?" he murmured, "and how I requited you with my insolence the next day?
I remember how wrongly I spoke to you, that is all.
Look here, lift up your head, I've something to show you."
She slowly faced him, glowing with beautiful shame.
"Do you know these roses?"
he said, drawing out his pocketbook, in which were treasured up some dead flowers.
"No," she replied with innocent curiosity. "Did I give them to you?"
"No, vanity, you did not. You may have worn sister roses, very probably."
She looked at them, wondering for a minute. Then she smiled a little as she said,
"They are from Helston, are they not? I know the deep indentations round the leaves. Oh, have you been there? When were you there?"
"I wanted to see the place where Margaret grew to what she is, even at the worst time of all, when I had no hope of ever calling her mine. I went there on my return from Havre."
"You must give them to me," she said, trying to take them out of his hand with gentle violence.
"Very well, only you must pay me for them."
"How shall I ever tell Aunt Shaw?" she whispered, after some time of delicious silence.
"Let me speak to her."
"Oh no, I owe to her. But what will she say?"
"I can guess. Her first exclamation will be, 'That man!'"
"Hush," said Margaret, "or I shall try and show you your mother's indignant tones as she says, 'That woman!'"
We hope you enjoyed this Brilliance audio production. Please visit the Amazon website to view all available titles in the Amazon Classics collection. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417. And now, please enjoy this exclusive Amazon Classics preview.
Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Chapter 1. There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning, but since dinner, Mrs. Reed, when there was no company, dined early. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so sombre and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight, with nipped fingers and toes, and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgiana Reed. The said Eliza, John, and Georgiana were now clustered round their mamma in the drawing-room. She lay reclined on a sofa by the fireside, and with her darlings about her, for the time neither quarrelling nor crying, looked perfectly happy. Me, she had dispensed from joining the group, saying she regretted to be under the necessity of keeping me at a distance, but that until she heard from Bessie and could discover by her own observation that I was endeavouring in good earnest to acquire a more sociable and childlike disposition, a more attractive and sprightly manner, something lighter, franker, more natural, as it were, she really must exclude me from privileges intended only for contented, happy little children. "What does Bessie say I have done?" I asked. "Jane, I don't like cavaliers or questioners. Besides, there is something truly forbidding in a child taking up her elders in that manner. Be seated somewhere, and until you can speak pleasantly, remain silent." A small breakfast room adjoined the drawing room. I slipped in there. It contained a bookcase. I soon possessed myself of a volume, taking care that it should be one stored with pictures. I mounted into the window seat, gathering up my feet. I sat cross-legged like a Turk, and having drawn the red moreen curtain nearly close, I was shrined in double retirement. Folds of scarlet drapery shut in my view to the right hand. To the left were the clear panes of glass, protecting but not separating me from the drear November day. At intervals, while turning over the leaves of my book, I studied the aspect of that winter afternoon. Afar, it offered a pale blank of mist and cloud. Near, a scene of wet lawn and storm-beat shrub, with ceaseless rain sweeping away wildly before a long and lamentable blast. I returned to my book, Bewick's History of British Birds. The letterpress thereof I cared little for, generally speaking, and yet there were certain introductory pages that, child as I was, I could not pass quite as a blank. There were those which treat of the haunts of sea fowl, of the solitary rocks and promontories by them only inhabited, of the coast of Norway, studded with isles from its southern extremity, the Lindesnes, or the Naze to the North Cape, where the northern ocean in vast whirls boils round the naked, melancholy isles of farthest Thule and the Atlantic surge pours in among the stormy Hebrides. Nor could I pass unnoticed the suggestion of the bleak shores of Lapland, Siberia, Spitsbergen, Nova Zembla, Iceland, Greenland, with the vast sweep of the Arctic zone and those forlorn regions of dreary space, that reservoir of frost and snow where firm fields of ice, the accumulation of centuries of winters, glazed in alpine heights above heights, surround the pole and consent to the multiplied rigors of extreme cold. Of these death-white realms I formed an idea of my own, shadowy, like all the half-comprehended notions that float dim through children's brains, but strangely impressive. The words in these introductory pages connected themselves with the succeeding vignettes and gave significance to the rock standing up alone in a sea of billow and spray, to the broken boat stranded on a desolate coast, to the cold and ghastly moon glancing through bars of cloud at a wreck just sinking. I cannot tell what sentiment haunted the quiet solitary churchyard with its inscribed headstone, its gate, its two trees, its low horizon, girdled by a broken wall in its newly risen crescent attesting the hour of eventide. The two ships becalmed on a torpid sea I believe to be marine phantoms. The fiend, pinning down the thief's pack behind him, I passed over quickly. It was an object of terror. So was the black-horned thing seated aloof on a rock, surveying a distant crowd surrounding a gallows.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.